Daniel Swift's grandfather was shot down over Holland in 1943 when he was a World War II bomber pilot. And that was just about all Daniel knew about his grandfather for years until he decided to find out more. During his search, Daniel also discovered the poets of the Second World War and their fascination with bombs and bomber pilots. In Bomber County, published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux, Mr. Swift recounts his own research into his grandfather's war story and includes some of the poetry that was born out of the European bombing campaigns. I'm very pleased that it brings Daniel Swift, an assistant professor of English at Skidmore College, to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
In a prologue, you write that you wanted to tell a story and that your grandfather's was available. If it hadn't been, would you have looked for another one?
I think it's a good question. What I mean by available there is a sense of wide open, perhaps is another way of putting it, in that this story was waiting to be told and therefore sort of asking to be told. Some of the urgency I felt in writing the book was a sense that, you know, a growing sense, in fact, as I read and researched more, that not only this man had been left out, but an enormous amount about him had been left out, his experience, the kind of war that he was involved in. So that it meant there was, you know, there was space for me to now discover an enormous amount and a real reason to do so. There was a kind of a drive built in to the story itself.
Well, there are certain things that you'll never know.
I think that's true. And I as I was writing the book, there were, you know, I used to wonder if there was one thing I could find out about him, what that would be. And I think this sounds like a silly thing to say, but I think I would have liked to know what he was like when he told a joke. I think I would have liked to know about a sense of humor, since that would seem to me something very human and very simple, and something, of course, that wasn't necessarily recorded.
Was the poetry part of what you wanted to write about from the start?
Yes and no. The book really began with a sort of a meeting of two things, which was my awareness when I was growing up that my grandfather simply wasn't there, so an awareness of an absence. And then as I read around the field, I mean, I should mention I teach poetry, but as I read around the field, I came up again and again against the claim that there was no poetry written about the Second World War. So this other absence seemed to me to reflect my own family absence in interesting ways. The two spoke to each other.
Well, there was a lot of poetry connected with World War One, and in Britain, people like Rupert Brooke and Siegfried Sassoon
exactly.
were quite famous for their World War One poets.
Exactly.
Poems were quite famous. But you discovered there was quite a bit of poetry written during World War II?
Yes, there was. And maybe I'm cheating slightly because I have to slightly shift the definition of what I think war poetry is. You mentioned the First World War poets, and they are, by definition, they're soldiers. They're soldiers who write poetry about their experiences in combat on the front. And what I want to argue in the book is that the Second World War is a very different type of war as the wars that we have now, and they involve civilians. And I don't see any reason why you can't include poetry written by civilians about the experience of war inside what we consider to be war poetry.
So was there a lot of poetry written by people who were affected by the Blitz or affected by the bombing in Poland and in France?
Enormous amounts. In the book, I focus upon poetry written by English and American poets. But yes, I mean, you couldn't escape the Blitz in London. And I talk at the beginning of the book about Dylan Thomas, who was terrified of the war. And in all sorts of ways, I mean, it wasn't that he was a pacifist, nor that he was simply a coward. There was a sort of mixture of worries he had about the war. And he tried to kind of escape being involved in the war. But both Cardiff, where he was living, and London, where he worked, were very heavily bombed. So he was forced up against the bombing. That same thing happens again and again.
Now, you could have written a book about World War II poetry and a different book about your grandfather's war experience. When did you decide to combine the two?
There isn't a single particular moment, as much as a kind of growing realization that, of several things, a growing realization about the sort of richness of this world that hadn't really been discussed before. So as I began to read again, I begin with this premise that there are things that have been left out, and I began to explore and discover, you know, wonderfully rich kinds of archives that people don't tend to talk about.
But there was an awful lot of fiction written about World War II.
Yes, so
in fact, a number of masterpieces came out of that war. So doesn't that tell us what we need to know? What does poetry do that that James Jones or Norman Mailer or any number of other writers didn't do?
It's a wonderful question. And the other great thing that there is for the Second World War is wonderful journalism. You know, it's this deeply covered war. What I think my simplest answer would be what journalism and the novels you mentioned do wonderfully is give a very specific perspective, what it feels like to be in a very particular place at a particular time. And that's a wonderful way of covering. I'm thinking about Norman Mailer, for example, gives an extraordinary sense of what it feels like to be in a certain kind of combat. But that's one particular place. And the bombing war is always double. It's always a war of two places, of the men in the planes and also the people underneath. Now, you can't be in two places at the same time. So you have to imagine one of those places. And that seems to me that's what the best of the poetry does, is imagine two places at the same time.
Did the poetry you found shed any light on what your grandfather's experience as a bomber may have been like?
I hope so. At a certain point, we have to imagine. At a certain point, you know, we can read the records and we can read the poetry. But there's a step that we have to take, I think, on our own and think, okay, that must have been what it felt like, in a sense.
Now, your grandfather kept journals and you've drawn heavily from them, but he wasn't a poet.
He wasn't a poet. And that's, you know, in a sense, that's wonderful for me, because what it means is I can use the poetry, many other people's poetry, to widen out his story. You know, this isn't just a family history, because that would only be of interest to immediate members of my family. What I hope to write is to use his particular story to tell a much wider kind of history. So the poetry is a way to widen out.
You're right that bombs were to World War II what the trenches were to World War I. There was a bit of an air war in World War I, but the planes are rather primitive. World War II planes, that began a whole new way of approaching a war, which we still engage in today.
Absolutely. And as I argue in the book, I think that the Second World War defines a lot of the ideas that we have about warfare now, about the way we fight wars now. There are enormous continuities between the debates about bombing during the Second World War and the kind of debates we have now about the use of unmanned planes, for example. There are many things that are the same between those conversations.
My guest is Daniel Swift. His book, Bomber County, The Poetry of a Lost Pilot's War, which is published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. Your paternal grandfather was named James Eric Swift. He died when your father was just 3 years old. And your father came with you on some of your research trips. What was it like for him to find out about a father he barely knew?
It was very powerful. What I think we both expected before we went on these journeys was that we thought this would be upsetting and sad. And it was that, certainly. But I think it was also, in a curious way, it was fun. It was fascinating. It was interesting. You know, the people we spoke to were, in Germany particularly, were people who had been bombed on the nights that my grandfather was bombing. So in a sense, we were meeting, you know, the victims of what my grandfather had done. And I was scared before these interviews that there might be some sense of anger still after this time. In fact, it didn't feel like that in the least. What it felt much more like was that everyone that I spoke to, we all shared a sort of community of suffering. Everyone had lost. So for my father and I, you know, it was fascinating. And it was also, in kind of curious ways, life-affirming, which sounds like a cliche, but I think is true. I want to write very much in the book about, not only about loss, and it is a story about loss, but also about finding, about things that are found and continue.
Did your research dissolve any of the myths that your father had constructed about his father?
Yes and no. And I write, again, there are several of these sort of myths and stories that my father grew up with that I mention in the book. The most enigmatic story about my grandfather is one that I will never be able to substantiate, which is that, you know, I've been told by my grandfather's sister that one night he drove off into an air raid in London. You know, he was stationed at a base near London. He drove into an air raid in order to experience what it was like, i.e. to imagine what was happening.
So he could understand what he was doing to other people.
Exactly. And this struck me as a very odd story. And I didn't think it was untrue, but perhaps it was in some way it was embellished. What I discovered in my reading was that lots of people did this. Lots and lots of people. They were called Blitz tourists. Lots of people went and tried to experience what it was like to be inside an air raid. So his particular unusual experience, this unusual anecdote about him, has a much larger kind of resonance with something that many people did, and that makes it more likely, and also slightly changes the way I think about it as an activity.
He was shot down, and then his body washed up in the Dutch coast.
Exactly.
Now, this is occupied Holland.
Exactly.
How was he found?
He was found, well, this again I find at the very end of the book itself. He was picked up, you know, his body washed up a couple of days after the plane had crashed, and he was picked up by German soldiers then, who very thoroughly described the body, and managed to find those German records of the body. But they also give him a military funeral with full honors. So I thought it was an interesting thing to learn, which was that, you know, nobody during this war itself treated the other side, and this is particularly true of the Germans and the English, with contempt. In a curious way, the soldiers had enormous respect for each other, for what they were doing.
Well, at least in 43.
In 43, exactly.
It changed by 45.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's particularly true, I think, of the English and the Germans, which is what people sometimes forget, is how close England and Germany were before the war, how friendly they were.
And how, in some cases, people in the royal family, people in in politics, were very friendly to Hitler. They had to make a decision.
Perhaps too friendly.
Well, the Mitford girls, for example,
exactly.
split on that.
Exactly.
You write that there was a renewed interest in poetry in London during the Blitz. Why do you think that was?
This is something that I speculate about in the book. I think that in times of trouble and ruin, it's very attractive to communicate with a sort of a continuous past of some kind. That could be one reason. Another reason could be, you know, if you have less time to read, you might be more likely to read poetry than you would be to read a great sprawling novel. You know, it could be, and again, this is something I guess at in the book, poetry almost in itself is a sort of broken art form. It's made of pieces. So if you're surrounded by rubble, perhaps this is an attractive thing to read at the time.
Do we have any idea whether something like that is happening in Iraq and Afghanistan?
My sense is that it isn't. My sense is that there was a great flowering of war poetry, as I argue in the book, during the Second World War, which has been replaced by other things in subsequent wars. You know, the great sort of definitive cultural coverage of something like the Vietnam War is a very different kind of thing.
Would you read one of these poems for us?
Certainly, I'd be happy to. What I'd like to read is not the whole, but part of a poem called Losses by Randall Jarrell. And Jarrell,
a pretty great poet.
A wonderful poet.
Did he fight in the war?
He didn't fight in the war. He was a trainer. So he stayed in America on an airbase and was responsible for training young pilots. And what interests me about the poem is this idea of distance, that you can be part of the war while not being actually on the front itself. So again, this is from Losses by Randall Jarrell. He writes, "It was not dying. Everybody died. It was not dying. We had died before in the routine crashes, and our fields called up the papers, wrote home to our folks, and the rates rose, all because of us. We died on the wrong page of the almanac, scattered on mountains 50 miles away, diving on haystacks, fighting with a friend. We blazed up on the lines we never saw." And then there's a sort of jump in the middle of the poem, and the young airmen suddenly are in action in Europe itself. And he writes, "In bombers named for girls, we burned the cities we had learned about in school till our lives wore out." What I love about this poem is, I think it's a wonderful poem, is that it captures for me the sense of novelty, the sense of surprise. These were kids. These were really, really young men. And they didn't really know what they were doing. And you can train someone to bomb, but actually the only real training for it is to actually involve yourself in a bombing run, is to begin bombing.
Well, most of the poets you write about, they were poets who wrote about the bombings. But were any of the bomber pilots themselves poets, or were they amateur poets?
Yes, a few. I found a few amateur poets in the Imperial War Museum in London, in the archives there. And as might be expected, because they were very distracted, theirs is not a kind of wonderfully finished poetry. But I did find poems written by people during training runs inside the planes themselves, and written, you know, in the evenings after they'd come back from a day of training, or in the morning after a night of bombing.
You also provide accounts from civilians who were the targets of the bombings, including Virginia Woolf, for example, Cecile Day Lewis, who both wrote about being in London during the Blitz. Did they have it? Well, Virginia Woolf was just such a great writer, but did she have a different way of talking about this because she was writing in prose?
Yes and no. I write and I feature sections from both her diaries and her letters, which are very fragmented and in many ways read more like poetry than like novels. She also gestures several times, interestingly to me, you know, in the ruins of London themselves, which she was obsessed by, as I mentioned before. People went to see the air raid damage, and she was someone who certainly did that. She suggests several times an idea about poetry, as if poetry might be an answer to the kind of damage and ruin she saw around her. So yes and no is the answer. She also loved to read poetry, and she was writing a book about English poetry during the Blitz itself.
You've called your book Bomber County. What is that?
Bomber County is the old nickname for the area of England. It's Lincolnshire. Technically, I use it to mean both Lincolnshire and Norfolk, two counties north of London, which is where all the bombing fields were based. And I like it as an image both of a particular moment, but also something that's lost to us. Nobody really calls Lincolnshire Bomber County now. But we can still go and visit Lincolnshire. We can still go and see these great flat areas. They're still there, but they're just underneath the sort of accustomed world. They're just underneath what we might usually see.
Critics of air war talk about the disconnect. The pilot is up there, pushes a button, bombs go out, sees little explosions, but has no real sense of what's happening. And in the case of the Dresden bomber, just how destructive the bombing can be. Were they aware of the power of what they were doing?
I think the answer to that, the best answer I can give is yes and no. I've spoken to enormous numbers of veterans of the bombing war, and without fail, they were aware, and they describe now their horror at what they were doing. They knew this was horrific because they knew how, at first at least, how inaccurate the bombs were, so how wide an area they were falling on. Even if they were saying that they were bombing a particular base or a particular railway station, they were really bombing whole cities. They were very aware of that after the raids themselves. However, they also believed this was enormously necessary and enormously important. So the horror is balanced with some kind of sense of duty.
I suspect that was particularly powerful for the people who dropped the atomic bombs in Japan.
Yes, I think that is absolutely true. The other thing that the bombers, the English bombers, which is not true of those who dropped the atomic bombs, was they were aware of what they were doing night after night, so they could see their comrades not returning.
But they were also glamorized, and we've seen any number of films in which they were glamorized. Did they feel like they were stars?
I think they did. I think that they felt that the real stars were the fighter pilots. Those were the ones who were really considered to be glamorous, and the bombers were the slightly less glamorous cousins of the fighters, as it were.
But all of them were putting their lives on the line, and there are all these films in which 40 planes go out and 30
exactly
return, and everybody's worried about who those 10 were.
Yeah, they were. And again, on a sort of lighter note, people often in my interviews spoke about, you know, how fun it was on the base, what life was like there, an enormous communal spirit, but a sense of sort of excitement and involvement, which is to do with the proximity of death in a way. A sort of, you know, having a party because you're so close to an awful catastrophe.
Daniel Swift has written for Book Forum, the New York Times Book Review, the Times Literary Supplement, and he has written a book called Bomber County, the Poetry of a Lost Pilot's War. He will be giving a seminar tomorrow at 2:00 at the Poets' House. And if you want more information about that, you can go to our show page at wnyc.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.